to stay put. It's really nice to be here. Tim sort of jokingly said, back by popular demand. I'm sure that's a case of they asked everybody else, but they couldn't make it, so they asked me again. But anyway, it genuinely is nice to be here. I did have a couple of people saying, why are you here in a slightly quizzical fashion? Because I'm sorry, I don't live in Cornwall. But it genuinely has been an inspiring day, and I've learned a lot. And Nick and I were saying, just this morning actually, that it would be great to do something like this, kind of UK-wide or even bigger. What I want to do is talk about how we build productive and engaged networks as people, because we're all people, but also as businesses and around our businesses. And I'm going to give a whole bunch of case studies, primarily from a big company perspective, because that's the sorts of organisations we work with. But our business, which is called 100% Open, is all about working between very big companies and small, creative, agile, innovative companies, and being a match.com, if you will, between large and small. Couple of things I just want to pick up on, which I loved. Initially, this from the video, Richard Glover was talking about Cornwall as a small business economy, which I think is a phenomenal strength, as I think he was as well, because I think all this stuff around collaboration comes very naturally to small businesses, because small businesses need to collaborate because they know they can't all do it themselves. 100% Open is a small business, I talk from personal experience there as well. I think bigger businesses find it much more difficult because they're used to having the economies of scale in theory, or in history at least, of doing it all themselves. So I think that is a tremendous strength in the Cornwall economy. Similarly, I love the fact that the TigerX 3D SMI collaboration, when they pitched it to Anglo-American, I don't know if the guys are still here, but they said, we really need you. And I see that again and again. And I'm going to present seven very quick case studies of big companies who are all the companies we work with, and I'm not going to name specific names, obviously, but they're all deeply, deeply dysfunctional, bureaucratic, slow, frustrating, all kinds of negative adjectives I could use to describe them. And that concept of we need you is absolutely true. So I would like to offer up my network, our network, to you, and if anybody wants to talk to me about how they can possibly get into some of the companies that I'm going to talk about, come and grab me afterwards, or catch me on Twitter, or follow up by email, or what have you, or by phone, we could do that. Two other things. I was talking with Tim last night, came down last night, he talked about reimagining this concept of it's not what you know, it's who you know, which is generally perceived as sort of a slightly snide, negative, old boys network sort of thing. But I think that is exactly the way this kind of 21st century economy works. And so I want to reimagine that in a positive way, because I think that is the way stuff gets done. Does that sound like a good use of half an hour? Let me rattle on. So a former chairman of mine, Chris Powell, used to say, networking is only one letter away from not working. He was being sarcastic. He very clearly knew the power of networking. But I just kind of share this as an initial statement, because networking is a bit of a dirty word. You know, it's something that's perceived as somehow not actually getting on with the day job. But I think it is increasingly core to the day job. In fact, it is the day job. It's the way we get stuff done. I think the 20th century was all about expertise, as Nick was saying this morning. It was all about the knowledge that we have. But I think the 21st century is about the networks that we build around us. So I think we need to shift that perception that somehow networking is a dirty word. Chris Powell was a consummate networker, and so this was very much said in jest. But a company that kind of stumbled into this space rather early, and I think are rather fascinating, and had the privilege to work with it in the last year or so, is Lego, who we sort of describe as reluctant pioneers in this space. So people who attended the last, who came to the last Partner to Succeed conference, by the way? Can I get a show of hands? Okay, actually it's dark, so I can't really tell, but I think it's about 30% or 50%, something like that. So just very quickly, I think I told this story last time, but just quickly to repeat. So 10 years ago, Lego developed a new product, a robot product, which is this thing here in the left-hand side, called Mindstorms. It was developed by an in-house team of 10 people, and within a couple of weeks of them launching this product, tens of thousands of people were in various online communities kind of raving about the product, talking about it, but more than that, they were hacking into the computer code in this programmable chip in the middle of this robot. And they were rewriting the code, making it better, making the robots do kind of new stuff that the original core team hadn't thought of. And this idea that, oh, by the way, Lego thought about trying to sue these people because, strictly speaking, they're infringing on Lego's copyright, but partly because they didn't act quickly enough, but also, to give them credit, they realised there was something interesting happening here and let's run with it and see what happens. They did run with it, and it became, at the time, Lego's most successful product of all time. And it's just, you know, for a very creative company like Lego, who then had won Toy of the Century, I think, around about the Toy of the Millennium, I think, actually, around the turn of the last century. It really precipitated a shift in mindset within their business that, genuinely, not all the smart people work within Lego, even though lots of smart people do. There are lots of real kind of fans outside of the organisation that have tremendous creativity, and now, when they try and do stuff, they really try to harness external creativity as much as they can. And I'm going to talk about two new examples, which are perhaps less familiar to you. So the next one here, Lego architecture. This is an interesting one because for years there was a guy whose name escapes me who had been building iconic architecture out of Lego. So this is, any architecture fans, guess what this is?
Falling Water.
Frank Gehry's Falling Water. They also have the Empire State Building and Tower Bridge and kind of famous buildings built out of Lego. Blinking expensive, by the way, kind of 60 odd quid for a packet of Lego. But anyway, that's another story. This guy had been doing this in a sort of tin pot operation, selling the kits totally unofficially at a small scale, but was building up some critical mass and some interest in what he was doing. It took about 10 years. I can't believe it took 10 years, but it took 10 years before Lego finally sort of ate humble pie and said, actually, that's a really good idea. We should do that together. And to cut a long story short, this is now a huge success. The guy who set up this business is now multi-millionaire, sort of tenfold, and Lego is doing very well, thank you very much, out of it as well. It's kind of ridiculous that it took 10 years. Apparently this guy approached Lego, umpteen times and kept on being rejected for all sorts of reasons. But anyway, the good news is he got there at the end and it's a success story. But it is difficult to get into Lego or any of these organisations, and that's part of what we do as a company, try and help you find the front door at the very least, if not a bit more than that. So Lego architecture.
Whoa.
Right, okay. don't know what to say about that. I don't think I touched anything. I'm going to keep on going. Sorry about that. I hope you're all alive. Right. This. Anybody know what this product range is called? Any Lego fans in the room? No. Okay. So this is very new. This is a challenge, a competition. A lot of what we do are competitions. I'll come to that in a minute. But this is a challenge that Lego put out a year ago, initially in Japan, and they've now just launched it as a global platform. It was quite a bold move by Lego, and it's paid off. But let me tell you how it works. So the deal is, anybody can submit a design. This ended up being a submarine, but all sorts of designs were submitted. And then the challenge that Lego put to the community were you had to find 10,000 fans of your design, not only who could say we like it and tick in the box, but help you make the design even better. So in the case of the submarine, there were actually 20 or 30 people who had a significant input into the design of that product. And none of these were Lego employees, these were all kind of fans, sort of geeks, fanboys like me. Once they'd reached that 10,000 threshold, Lego made a commitment to do its utmost. They had some caveats, but essentially it was, we will produce this thing, we'll put it in a box, we'll have the nice instructions, we'll put it through our infrastructure, we'll sell it through our sales channels. And more importantly than that, we will share some of the revenue. Only 1%, which sounds possibly quite stingy, but 1% of a big kind of new product range is still a significant revenue. And a really smart move, I think, on behalf of Lego was, they encourage the, it's hard for a company like Lego to share fractions of 1% with 30 different people. That's just an administrative burden. But what they did was they gave the original person who came up with the idea for the submarine 1%, and then put significant peer pressure on that individual to share that 1% with the people within the community who, in this case it was a he, deemed to have helped him the most. So it's a smart move. It remains to be seen. It is a successful kind of program. It's one that they're scaling up. And I just think it's a kind of interesting business model, not least because Lego didn't spend a penny on production, which is of course where most of where the cost lies in a business like Lego, in a production-based business. They didn't spend a penny on this business until they already had over 10,000 customers saying, "We will buy this if you produce it." So it's normally in kind of the product development world, you build it and then you market it. This was essentially marketing it before you build it. I think that's interesting. It remains to be seen how that works. But anyway, Lego, very interesting. Kind of stumbled into this space very much by accident, by design. And still plenty of things about Lego which could be better. But they're sort of heading in the right direction. And then their mindset is in the right place, or at least it's heading more in the right place. So I think they're quite interesting. Another lesson that we've learned, I love this quote, innovation is a U-shaped process, from a guy called Paul Bannings at Oxfam, who I'm going to talk about next, who what he means by that is innovation is kind of fun at the beginning when you're meeting new people at events like this, or you're having the workshop and posting the walls with post-it notes. And it's fun at the end when you're making money or creating value, whatever that means, social value for Oxfam. But it's generally bloody awful in the middle when you've got, especially in a collaboration, multiple partners pulling in different directions, perhaps a different articulation of what it is you're trying to work on, an ill-thought-through business plan, all kinds of things which are not yet fully formed. So it's really important to have a process, but also to create a safe space whereby you can allow that proposition to emerge and flourish and hopefully get to the other side of the U. And I mean, Oxfam had, I hope they don't mind me telling you this, don't tell them I told you, they had quite a track record of, a bit like Lego 10 years ago, getting in a huddle in an internal team, developing a big new fundraising innovation. So a big thing that Oxfam has to do is think of creative ways of taking money from us and others to support their charitable ends. And I think they're a great charity, by the way. I'm not criticising them for this. But anyway, they had a great track record of, in a small internal team, developing a new fundraising thing, launching it, and then it being a sort of glorious failure. Or not so glorious failure. So they decided, why don't we have an external conversation with some of our external partners, big aha moment, why don't we collaborate? So we recently ran a series of workshops with them. The first was with regular donors, the second was with a bunch of partners, including Google and some other charities, and then the third was an internal team that was kind of nutting out the business case of some of these things. These are all kind of coming through to market now, but it was a lot cheaper to do it that way. It was a hell of a lot faster. I think sometimes when you're collaborating, because you're building up an external expectation, it forces you to be more on your game as well, whereas if you're just doing it in-house, you can allow yourself to be lazy, and I think Oxfam, by their own admission, have kind of fallen into that trap. So the jury's still out whether this is a better way of working. I'm pretty damn sure it is, but we shall see. So innovation being a U-shaped process, and it applies in the charity space as well as the commercial space. Another lesson I've learned just through personal experience is that a lot of the companies we work with are very sales-led. You know, they have very slick kind of sales guys who jump straight into the transaction. But I think the art of this kind of collaborative economy is to have lots of conversations, whether it's at events like this or lots of one-to-one coffees, get caffeine poisoning, or via social media and other kind of online tools. Some of those conversations will turn into relationships, and some of those relationships will ultimately end up in business. And I think it's important to see that kind of funnel, that process, and not jump straight into transaction mode. I think if you're jumping straight to transaction, you're almost likely selling a kind of commodity and you want to move up the relationship chain. And you certainly can't do it the other way around. So this is a lesson that we've learned. And an example I want to give of this, perhaps slightly ironically, is Procter & Gamble, a massive fast-moving consumer goods company who have brands such as Gillette and Ariel and Duracell. People may be aware, or some people may be aware, that P&G had a target for 50% of all their new product and service ideas to come from outside of the company. And they've been doing this also for nearly a decade, which is quite radical for a company like P&G. Part of the reason they did that, by the way, is P&G have essentially an HR policy where they only promote from within. So they recruit generally at graduate level, or possibly straight from school, and promote from within, which means they have a very kind of homogenous, aligned culture, but they don't have the diversity that is required for kind of innovation and the spark of genius for kind of new product development. So this was a deliberate strategy that kind of offset the benefits of their HR policy, which is having this kind of group think kind of effect on the business. One of the things we've worked with P&G recently is I've been slightly just amazed